Hello, everybody. Welcome to Health Sciences System Committee meeting. Could we have a roll call, please?
Chair DeBrava?
Here.
Vice Chair McAdoo? Here. Regent Carvalho?
Here.
Regent Moran? Regent Trachok? You have a quorum present.
Thank you. We will take public comment. Do we have any public comment in ELCO?
No public comment from ELCO.
Thank you. Any public comment in Las Vegas? And if you'd please state your name and spell your last name for the record, please.
Brian Lauzon, L-A-U-Z-O-N. Okay. Good to go? Okay. Thank you for having me, and good morning. I sit on the advisory board for UNLV School of Medicine, as well as the UNLV practice plan. I'm here today to share with you my most significant concerns and observations while sitting on these boards. I am concerned with the strategic focus for the UNLV School of Medicine. It appears to be in limbo. So the sooner the dean position is filled, whether permanently or with an interim dean, the better off the School of Medicine will be. The advisory board for the School of Medicine is really not a functioning board. Meetings have been sparse and are not interactive or productive. As an example of what can and should happen, I respect how the hospitality college dean Shoemaker solicits feedback, listens to, and relies on the hotel global advisory board to provide relevant business and industrial advice. I suggest the School of Medicine board be structured in a similar manner. The UNLV practice plan board of directors is much more hands-on. That being said, the most critical negotiation that is taking place is the strategic alliance with UMC. It seems that these two sides are not talking openly on how they should move forward as a team. I do not believe they have shared or created a joint strategic vision. By not doing so, they lack clarity on how to best move forward. I used to work for Mars Incorporated and have lived in many continents dealing with global expansion. I've negotiated with a number of countries around the world on how best to bring our products to their market. We always had an agreed vision which identified how the operation would look once completed and the benefits to the community. The vision addressed land, building manufacturing, creating jobs, tax incentives, etc. It was all inclusive. I strongly suggest the current management from UNLV practice plan and UMC sit down and develop a joint strategic vision and positioning. Once completed, an agreement can be finalized with clear roles and responsibilities. Thank you for listening and considering my recommendations.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, any public comment in Reno? Seeing none, we will go to item two, the minutes for possible action. Do I have any discussion about the minutes or any motion? I have a motion. Do I have a second? We have a second. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Chair's report. For the sake of time, things are moving along, and obviously we have two medical schools, nursing programs, allied health programs, dentistry, all important to this committee, social work. So we'll get into our agenda, going to item four, UNLV School of Medicine report, information only. Dean Atkinson.
Thank you, everyone, and good morning. I'm happy to be here to give my report. Let's see if I can get this to move. Yeah, that's this one. Oh, okay, good. I thought I'd start with the most exciting piece, which is what our new students are going to look like as they begin their class. They start on July 15th. This is our third class starting. We have 60 students, and I have a little bit of adjustment to what the numbers were. Once the students can accept one position, you still can make adjustments, because if they get on a waiting list of someplace else and want to move, they can take another spot. So I have here the list of the ethnic and racial outline of our students. We have now got three African-American students. We increased one. That's one less than we had. We've increased one of Hispanic student. Everything else is exactly the same. So we have a 20% ratio of underrepresented minorities in medicine. That is very good for most medical schools are under about 10%. And so we're very pleased by that. And we have a very high MCAT score of 510. National average is about 500, maybe 499. So 510 is very good. GPA 375. We have a fair number of kids, 21, that are first in college for their families. That's about the same as the 20% underrepresented minorities, but it's not completely the same populations. We now only have three veterans. We had started out with four. The nice thing about the three veterans is two of them are already on military scholarships. That means that they'll enter the military service for their residency programs and for their first years of their career as a payback, but that helps with the scholarships for some of our students. And we have one rural student this year. We had one in our first class from Pahrump. This student is from Fallon, Nevada, and we're pleased to have her. The next slide shows where our students came from. We took, for the 60, we took 22 from UNLV, 9 from UNR, 1 from Nevada State, and then 28 out-of-state institutions among our student body. The students are all from Nevada. I think 50 or so of them are Nevada residents right now. The rest of them have all been from Nevada before or have parents or grandparents in Nevada, so they have strong ties if they're not directly from here. So you can see the list here. It's really pretty exceptional list. Barnard, BYU, Case Western, Chapman, Cornell, Johns Hopkins, Mount Mary, Northwestern, Princeton, Santa Clara, Ohio State, Berkeley, UCLA, UC San Diego, UC Santa Cruz, USC, UCF, University of Miami, University of Washington, and Vanderbilt. So we're pleased. We think we really have a good class coming in, and our other classes are moving along well, too. Our second class is moving into their third year, and they've started their clinical work, and our second class is moving up into the second year, but they're spending the summer doing research during the summer and taking vacation during the summer. So things are going well with the student body. Our legislative update, we were very active during the legislative sessions. We had a lot of bills that we thought were really important. We did the HHS SB 363 for a Nevada Stem Cell Center. We talked about autism, and there was an autism day as well, testified for that. The physician's day at the legislature was important. And we were obviously in support to a number of legislators individually and together for our money for our added accreditation for the third and fourth year classes. We were able to receive the $14 million for the next 2 years. So our third year curriculum and our fourth year curriculum is well on the way to going forward. Then the last piece was that Senator Jackie Rosen came and visited our campus. She's obviously a very important advocate for us and for all of Nevada, and we're really pleased. Her husband is a physician. She understands medical education very well. She's supporting bills for expanding GME across the country as well as in our state. So we had a very good discussion with her, as our medical students did as well. She's particularly interested in geriatrics medicine, and that's one of the programs that we're adding next year in our residency program, to add a fellowship in geriatrics medicine. We received money from the state of Nevada in this appropriation, in the last session, to be able to begin that geriatrics program. So we had an interesting discussion on that. The other important thing from that I'd like to report on the legislative piece is that we've been working on finalizing the plan for the medical education building, we have a timeline now that we'll be meeting deadlines for the 9-acre land, county land, and support from the SB 553 allocation of the state. So we'll be presenting those to you all at a special meeting of for your consideration at a special meeting of the Board of Regents on July 19th. So you'll be hearing that coming up, and so I won't talk more about that at this point. We had an accreditation visit that was really important. In February, we had a four-day meeting with the Liaison Committee of Medical Education that accredits medical schools. We received the draft survey and report of the survey team finding from them, and we responded to that since this was written. We still have not heard yet. The committee will be meeting, we think, on June 20th. We're not positive that it made the deadline to be in at that meeting. If it's not then, it will happen in September. But we're expecting to hear the outcome of that decision. I guess I'd say, as I've told several of you before, it was a very difficult review. It's always good to have feedback on things. We certainly know we had to monitor things in the future, things that we hadn't done yet in the third and fourth year curriculum that we were saying that we were going to do are going to be monitored to show that we did them afterwards. And then there were some other issues that we're going to be addressing. And so we're anxious to see how that all turns out. In terms of fundraising, the most recent thing is that we were lucky enough to have a $6 million bequest that has been made for the medical school. I think it's a wonderful lady. Her husband died in the last year, and she's donated the money from her bequest, and I'm hoping that she doesn't die soon, although she's pretty young, I think we'll. But we're very pleased about this, and so it's really good. And we'll be towards student scholarships as the main endowment. The Engelstadt Foundation pledged, again, a match for students for our third-year class coming in. I so far have only been able to find three of those matches, so we have six more endowments, six more pledges for the third year class. So that is, we have 25 from the original Engelstad, three more from them, three more to that, and we have one additional one that we received before we got the information on the Engelstad match. So we have just over 30 students for our next class that will have full scholarships. We have the two military ones, and we'll have some money left to give partial scholarships to the rest of the students. The research update is we have the Midwestern Clinical Translational Research Infrastructure Award, and they have that's the award that comes from the federal government for $20 million over 5 years to build infrastructure for clinical research in Nevada. The PI is Parvesh Kumar from the School of Medicine, and he works with 17 different universities in about seven different Midwestern states. It includes Hawaii and Alaska, as well as Wyoming, Montana, Idaho, and then Nevada. And they have a meeting coming up on June 10th to 11th where all their investigators and the vice provosts or the vice presidents for research come and interact. And so they'll be having their annual meeting. They have nearly 200 people now that come to that meeting. They give out research grants to start up clinical trials and then to help investigators actually get funded at a national level. This year's meeting is going to be on health disparities and on the opioid crisis, because we think those are both areas that are extremely important for additional funding, both for our state but for this whole region. And with that, I have our university UNLV medicine updates. Michael Gardner, the Vice Dean for Clinical Affairs, will talk about those. I'll start out just with this to talk about the new things that they've launched in the last few months. And you can go ahead.
Good morning. Welcome, Dr. Gardner.
Yes, sir.
Just letting you know, you have about 8 minutes for finishing this agenda item, and then we want to jump into the next one about the affiliation agreement. So if you can just kind of go accordingly.
Yes, sir. Michael Gardner, for the record, Vice Dean, Clinical Affairs, UNLV School of Medicine. Wanted to just give you brief updates about where we are. I will not take more than 8 minutes. Thank you, Regent DeBrava. We have launched an automated appointment reminder system for our patients. We've also expanded our call center. I've actually gotten questions about our call center as of the volume has increased much more than we expected. So we've actually doubled the number, almost tripled the number of people working at it. And on Monday, we will have the ability for the virtual hold. Many of you have done this with other companies where they say, would you like, instead of standing in line, would you like us to call you back? And so that will help us on our high times, high call volume times. We've got some patient access initiatives. We are getting same-day appointments, wait list. We've been working closely with our partners at UMC to improve referrals from the emergency room. They need a lot of referrals from the emergency room, and frankly, we're happy to take them. So we're working to streamline that process so people seen who may not have physicians that come into UMC, we can get them in our clinics, and hopefully they become our patients. As you know, that was in the past, it was an issue about compliance training. We have completed attending fellow and resident physician compliance training throughout UNLV Medicine. That will be done annually, and for physicians that are having issues, it'll be done more frequently, up to and including monthly if needed, to ensure that their billing and coding is correct and meeting normal standards. The MIPS is a program that from CMS for Medicare, where you get money for higher quality. We've have two areas. This slide talks about we went from 83 to 100. The most recent submission, we're still at 100. There's another measure that we were 40 out of 40. So that's a maxing, and potentially that increases our reimbursement for Medicare. Now, As I've alluded to in the past two board meetings, this has been a tough year for us. So we're going to talk about where we are. We're not happy about where we are and where our projections are for the year and what we're planning to do about it in the coming year. We had a loss of, right as of the end of January, $8.9 million. We're projecting with that continues through. We've had a balance sheet decrease of $2.5 million, mainly from accounts receivable reduction, and we'll talk about that. We have had an increase in cash. We are paying our bills. We do not have creditors coming to our doors asking why you haven't. And I don't mean that in a facetious way. I mean, I think that the board would be appropriately concerned. You know, do we have companies out there that aren't getting paid? We are paying our bills. As of when this was turned in, our faculty salaries were overdue at $3.2 million. As of May 31st, that number is $2.6 million. There are five accounts that are still open. There's 11 accounts that are paid off as of that were up to date as of May 31st. Three of those accounts are faculty salary. Two of those are leases, about a little bit more than $500,000 in leases, and just a little bit north of $2 million in faculty salaries. Is our expectation that we'll pay at least $1 million in the month of June to pay that down, depending on reimbursements, particularly from insurance companies, it may be more than that, but we feel very comfortable committing to at least $1 million in the month of June to pay that down.
Can we get a cash flow summary?
We can get, yes, sir, we'll get you that to you. And we'll get that to the entire board next week, if that's soon enough for you, Regent Trachak. I only mentioned the loan because it's come up. We have not used a loan since for over a year. Many of you on the board were involved in that process. So that 14.7 is where we stopped. We used a loan principally for the first 3 to 4 months for faculty salaries as during the transition. That occurred actually before my arrival. And then there was about approximately $6 million, just a little bit less of that, that was used for the EPIC implementation. So we have not used it, and we're not going to use it. And frankly, even if we wanted to, we can't use it anymore. So there's no additional loan debt, and we will not be adding to that. But that question had come up, so I wanted to make clear that we're not using the loan anymore. And we are working with Main Campus about the payoff process for that. So how do we get our money? Well, our fee-for-service breakdown, about 56% is just direct fee-for-service. We also get about a third of our income is professional services agreements. These are things like call contracts. We, for example, cover labor and delivery 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at UMC, but also at Sunrise. And we get about $1.5 million from each institution, roughly, for that coverage. Plus, we get the collections for whatever work is done while we're covering those hospitals. And then we have one pharmacy, which is at Mojave, and that pharmacy actually generates about around just under $4 million a year. The fee-for-service revenue was down this year, principally, we believe, because there was a significant decrease in visits early on in the fiscal year when we implemented EPIC. Nationally, the prediction is a 25% decrease for the first 6 months. It wasn't that bad for us. It was more like 15%, but it was still definitely a collection. And I'd been asked if that's true even when you go from those numbers true when you go from paper to EPIC, or also if you go from another EMR to EPIC, and it's true for both. There is a learning curve. The revenue was, we're going to talk about the Centricity billing write-off, which was a significant, was almost a $4 million write-off of cash flow, and we can of accounts receivable, and that was a non-cash but accounts receivable write-off. Thankfully, that's a one-time only thing, but it was a significant hit to our bottom line this year. Other revenue is down a little less than 1%, and our pharmacy revenue is actually up. Total clinical, so how do we spend things? Our salaries, including clinical doctors, is 58%. Our operating expenses, rent, pharmacies costs, supplies, that's about 24%. And then our general and administrative expenses, what are those? How we do our billing, covering administrative things, and frankly, this year, a significant expense in EPIC computers expenses and consultants. As you may remember, we are a Community Connect member with UMC. In other words, everything we do with Epic, we go through UMC. UMC has had, and I don't think that they would disagree with this, substantial challenges with their Epic implementation. They've also spent literally millions of dollars on their own consultants with Epic, as well as we have. So when you look at what the financial overview, I'm sorry, Chair Page.
I just had a quick question around the Epic, the computer expense. How much additional computer expense? Because I thought when the practice plan started up that we got all new computers. Is it something different?
Well, actually, we brought over, as you may remember, Chair Page, that we brought over computers from UNR. Many of those, not all of them, but many of them, frankly, weren't new enough and had enough memory and things to be able to handle Epic. So we had to buy new computers and new hardware to be able to meet Epic demands. So that was one expense. And then we depreciate, our auditors expect us to depreciate those computers. So as you can see on the fifth line of this slide, sixth line, there's $500,000 of depreciation on that. But going back to the, does that?
No, I'm just curious how much, and you might not know the answer now, how much do we spend on new computers when we transition from UNR to UNLV for the practice plan? Because I thought there was a large number for that exact reason. You said the at that time it was said that the computers weren't up to speed, and we got new computers at that time. So I'm just curious.
I'll get you those exact numbers. I want to be real careful that I don't. But I do know we replaced a large percentage of our computers because they just weren't able to handle what the technical requirements, the hardware requirements for Epic implementation. But I will get you those numbers as well as the cash flow statement.
Thank you.
And we've alluded to this before, and this is not the time or place to debate the why of this, but the mathematical fact is that UMC reduced their support to us by $3.2 million. As far back as I can go, which is approximately 10 years, both between UNLV and UNR, this is the lowest, this year is the lowest amount of economic support we're getting from UMC for at least a decade. We also had CB, the one-time write-off for the bad debt for the CB, which took off almost $4 million off our accounts receivable. When you put those together, that's $7.1 million right there. When you look at Epic, we did have increase. We hired people for credentialing. We hired people for revenue cycle in our call center. When you add all that together, that was almost $900,000 in expense. We had a $3.2 million increase in faculty salaries. We have been hiring physicians. This is a good thing because many of these are in specialties that can generate revenue for us. And then you can see where we had to get extra with the Epic transition. We had to have, when you add all that up, $1.7 million between the depreciation of computers and outside consultants as we did the implementation of Epic. Frankly, that was a lot due to the fact that the Epic implementation with our partners from UMC didn't go as well as we had hoped. So we had to do a lot of stuff with our revenue cycle to make up, not lose too much money in the process. When you add all that up, it comes out to we are trending loss and expense increase. That's $12.9 million. We're trending for a loss of about $11.4 million, but because of the LIC, the longitudinal clerkship, we know that our docs are doing more teaching, so we changed some of the balance between School of Medicine and practice plan salaries from 95% practice plan, 5% school, to more like 10% school, 90% practice plan. That is a significant amount of money, as you might imagine. That's about $3.2 million. And then we have already started decreasing our Epic consultants, so we're saving about $350,000 in the last quarter of this year. And we've seen a small but real increase in visits. If you look at our May visits, it was up to 10,700, you know, before we were doing in the low tens. But more importantly, or just as importantly, we're seeing an increase in our inpatient work. So we've seen a good 10% increase in our inpatient work. And the reason why I care about that, that's about 6,000. We get paid more for every inpatient we see than we do for our inpatient work than outpatient. So obviously we want to grow our clinics, we want to grow our outpatient, but it's also just as important that we grow our inpatient. Okay, so when you add that all up, we're projecting a loss for the year of about somewhere between, when we wrote this slide, it was 7.6 million. We think we're in that range. It could be maybe as high as 7.8, but it's in that range. So it's been, obviously we're not happy with this. We do not think that this is sustainable, and we need to change in conversations with President Miana, Dean Atkinson, some of the board members. We realize that we need to get back to a break-even position. For the first time, we've worked with our department chairs with a combination budget, and they were expected to turn in break-even budgets, with the one exception of pediatrics, which frankly has been a department that is losing money, and we've asked them to ameliorate some of their loss. Now, they do get, pediatrics does get about $1 million of support from Sunrise, academic support, that helps defray some of their losses. We've been working very closely, as you all know, Joanne Strobe is our senior associate dean for finance, is also our chief financial officer of the practice plan. And so we've been able to work closely. She's been invaluable in helping us have joint budgets and working together to make sure that the school and the practice plan are working together. We've been working to increase, and we've had some success with this, getting increased revenue from the hospitals, principally UMC and Sunrise, although I will tell you that we also have a growing presence at the VA, and the VA has been paying us more. And let me just say as an aside, forgive me, Regent DeBrava, I think we don't do a good enough job about, for lack of a better word, bragging about our relationship with Nellis and the Air Force Base, and also with UNL, and also with the VA, and how much we're working with the Department of Defense to help train future military physicians. And also present military physicians, for that matter. We have introduced and we presented it to the president, a physician compensation model that for the first time in the history of the Southern campus, it's based, will actually incentivize physicians to see more patients. We're hopeful to implement that July 1st. It is principally based, if you read the Reno plan that was implemented this year and you read ours, it's about 80% the same. There's a few tweaks and changes because we have some specialists on our practice plan that Reno doesn't have, but it's a fairly boilerplate vanilla plan. It's, to be honest, similar to the plan I saw as an assistant professor in 1996 at UNLV, at UNM in Albuquerque. And we had at Baylor, we had at Emory, and places I've been faculty. So the idea is to incentivize faculty to actually see patients, and for the faculty that are doing, you know, above average significantly, to reward them for that. And hopefully not many, but there will be a few faculty that are just not producing within national standards, and they may see over time, I think this will be a small minority, but they may see decreases in pay.
Dr. Gardner,
if
I may just interrupt, that was a long 8 minutes. I'm going to have to kind of reel you in a little bit.
Do you want me to do my last slide or not do my last slide?
No, we read your last slide, and obviously some tough times that you experienced this last year financially, and we've had conversations offline that seems like there's a plan to turn this thing around, but I know we have concerned members of the board. Were there any questions for Dr. Gardner on this? Chair Page.
Thank you. I'm just curious on the write-offs. How long were those receivables outstanding, and what did you guys do to try to collect it before you wrote it off?
So the centricity, and I want to first off thank Jeremy Altup here because he actually helped us. The original transition document said that we would go off centricity July 1st, 2018. Typically, when one switches from one account to another, you keep both EMRs going for at least six months, if not a year. That's obviously very expensive because you're paying for two EMR licenses. Our friends up here knew that they had a large and very expensive upgrade to centricity, and that's on a per-license basis. So the original deal is we were supposed to go off to July 1st. I pleaded and begged Jeremy, and I think those are the right verbs, to let us stay on to October 1st, because we had from March, April, May, June, when we were still on Centricity, accounts receivable that we needed to then manually put in to Resolute, which is our Epic billing program. We were able to get most, but frankly, Chair Page, not all of them. And so those were mainly Medicaid. And on October 1st, when we lost our access to Centricity billing, we were blind to those. We didn't, and you can't do paper billings with Medicaid and Medicare and even the insurance companies anymore. So we weren't able to work those billings anymore. Our friends on main campus, Chris Vitton, comptroller, and I agree with his, when he was reviewing our books, felt like that the right thing to do is to declare that that was a loss and write that off. That doesn't mean that we won't collect some of that 3.9, but we did not want to keep that on the accounts receivable. We wanted to assume that that was going to be a zero, and we felt like the right thing to do, the prudent thing to do, would be just to write that off. We recently are starting our new audit process. We actually mentioned that in our meeting with our auditors, and they agreed that that was the prudent way of approaching it. So that was – to answer your question, those were from maybe as early as February or March, but mainly April, May, June of 2018 that we were trying to work, but we couldn't get them all done by October 1st, 2018.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, I'd like to move into item 5, and that
Thank
is
you.
The a report on the affiliation agreement between University Medical Center and UNLV. Dean Atkinson, please.
Thank you. Barbara Atkinson, for the record. Thank you for this agenda item. What we have here is a Fourth Amendment to the affiliation agreement between UMC and UNLV School of Medicine. This is an agreement that was first entered into in 2016, has been amended a couple times in between. What's been really added here, the agreement stands pretty much the same as it did in the very first preliminary agreement. What's added is a page that has the residency programs and the amount of money that's going to be paid to the School of Medicine for the residency program specifically. This is the third year of looking at our residency programs to decide how much money what comes from the federal government comes to the hospital, and then the residents are employed by the university. So the money transfers over as federal money transferring through UMC to the School of Medicine to pay for their salaries. Then there's a piece that pays for their program directors and some of the other administrative work of each of the residents. So that's what we're looking at here. So this, if you look at schedule, it's called Schedule 1, and it's the one from 2019 to 2020. What UMC has done is add a percentage of extra revenue for each of the residents so that their salaries went up by 1%. We had requested 2%, but weren't not able to negotiate up to 2%. But 1% will help us not lose any more additional money. We're really in one of the lowest 25th percentile or so of what resident salaries are in the Western region. But we're still pleased with this. You might see, if you compare the schedules, that it looks like UMC went down 5 residents. UMC has 210 residents at UMC this new year coming up, and we had 215 before. But in really reviewing that to see what actually happened, we've increased our total resident number from 300 residents to 325. Of the 325 new residents, 210 are going to be at UMC, but the rest of them most of the increase went to other places. Sunrise Hospital is now paying for 21 residents. The VA Hospital in Las Vegas is paying for 37 resident spots. Nellis Air Force Base is paying for 19. the community hospital in rural family medicine is paying for 3.6, 3.5 residents. Family medicine clinics pay for 7. Psychiatry and psychiatry services, both inpatient and outpatient services in Las Vegas, pays for 16. And 8 of them are paid now from grants from the GME pot from the governor's budget. So we ended up totally with more residents than we had before and a 1% salary increase. So we're pleased with how that turned out. This was the year that we were trying to work on a master affiliation agreement between UMC and UNLV, and we spent the year working very hard on that master affiliation agreement. We actually started talking about how we would become an academic health center together with the hospital and the university in the very beginning, and as part of the preliminary agreement. That agreement has 10 years to run, and so we are going to continue it until we can negotiate a master agreement. What we did this year, and we actually started this right from the beginning, we had committees for each of the separate areas within that agreement. So we had a student and resident education committee, a research committee, a clinical activities committee that worked on professional services agreements and other kinds of clinical activities together, a joint marketing and branding committee, and then an executive committee from the leadership of both groups. And those, each of those committees met monthly, very intensively over the last year. We also started in January with an executive committee that met weekly and went through each of the individual areas. From the university, we had several areas that we were looking at working together and planning together, and we're still working and planning together. We just aren't finished yet. We have a new marketing and branding group that's going to be working together, and so we're hopeful that we'll be able to continue these discussions as we go ahead. So that's where we stand on the master affiliation agreement. As I said, we've got 7 years to go on the preliminary agreement, so we should be able to do something within that amount of time.
Thank you, Dean Eckerson. Any questions or comments? I did have a comment. I just wanted to go on the public record to say to our friends at the County Commission and the Hospital Advisory Board at UMC that I think it's paramount and very important that the public medical school in Southern Nevada, and that would be UNLV, and the public hospital in Southern Nevada would be UMC, they have to come together, because the synergy is that's the potential that we have. And the taxpayer also wants to see that. They want to maximize the money that's invested into UNLV School of Medicine. And if you pay property tax and there's money going to UMC, these two have to come together. And I just wanted to go on the record to say that I'm all in favor of that. That doesn't mean that the UNLV School of Medicine has to be exclusive only. They can do other things with other hospitals, and that's what's going to make the UNLV School of Medicine even better. So, again, I wanted to make sure that everyone knew that my position is that there should be an affiliation and a master affiliation with UMC and UNLV School of Medicine.
Thank you.
Seeing no other, Chair Page.
Thank you, Regent Abrava. So, Amendment E, are you guys working on that? It says effective July 1st, 2009. You think you're going to have it signed by then?
I'm sorry, 2019?
It says effective July 1st, 2019.
We're working just on the amendment is just for the preliminary agreement. So it's a fourth preliminary agreement, and that's what we'll have done by July 1st. We'll be continuing to work on a master affiliation agreement the next time that we can get one ready to go. It's not ready to go at this point.
No, okay. I'm just clarification, because it's in here. It's not signed. All the other ones are signed.
Oh,
so your goal is you will have it signed by July 1st.
It wasn't signed when it went into the book, but it's signed now.
Perfect. Thank you.
Regent Trachark, you had a question.
Yes. Taking a look, if you could please, Dean, at Schedule 1 of the agreement amendment that was just signed. It looks to me like you have about $22.5 million in support that is coming from UMC pursuant to this agreement.
Schedule 1, that's the 220, 19 to 20 agreement?
The agreement that was just signed.
Yes.
So we have $22.5 million that's coming from UMC. Did I read this schedule correctly?
It's 14.8 plus 3.7, so I think it's $18.5 million.
Sorry.
Unless I'm looking at some different
spot. No, your math is a lot better than mine. What are these numbers in the chart here?
It's actual numbers of residents in each year of their residency program. So so if you look at emergency medicine, there's 8 first-year residents, 8 second, 7 third, and for a total of 23 out of that program.
And so the total number of these residencies, the salaries for that would be encompassed in the 14.8.
Right. Okay. That's in the 14 million. And the 3.7 million, the way the federal government does the money when they give it out to the hospitals, and they always give it to hospitals, not directly to a university, but to the hospital, they give the direct salary for those residents, and that's in this case, the $14.8 million is the salaries for the residents that total up for that hospital's amount. But then the other part is called indirect medical expenses. The direct GME expenses are the salaries. The indirect is the $3.7 million, and that's called UMC calls it their academic mission support. I would actually call it their indirect medical education support, because we use that to pay things that are required that you have to have. So you have to have a program director for every program. If the program is big enough, it has to have multiple assistant and associate program directors, and that's the money that pays that support.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
And Regent Carvalho, please.
Thank you. So there's a difference between that 3.7 federal support and the 3.2 UMC mission support. Those are different amounts. The UMC mission support was on the previous agenda item.
Yes, that's different.
Okay.
Yeah, yes, this is 3.7 comes for that. It is really used for the same thing, for the money to use to pay the program directors. So it's an educational support.
So at one time, UNLV was or could have gotten 6.9
yes,
combined
we did.
From UMC and federally, and now it's only receiving 3.7.
Right. Okay. So it was UMC that decreased the amount of that support.
Okay. And is that something that will be gotten again, or what is the status of that?
We're continuing to discuss that with UMC.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Dean Atkinson.
Thanks.
We're going to jump right into 6, UNR School of Medicine report. Dean Schwang, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Health Sciences Committee. Tom Schwenk for the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. I'm going to take about 30 minutes of material and do it in 3 minutes. You have an outline. I'm just going to pick out literally 4 or 5 highlights. With regard to match day, I just want to close that discussion. You heard some of the preliminary reports. At the end of match week, we had one student unmatched, but subsequently did place that student in a very high-quality program, so we can claim 100% match rate for our medical students in this past cycle. And as you also heard, all of our residency programs matched on Monday morning of match week as well. Our medical student admissions numbers are very similar to UNLV, slightly larger class, so a few more in each of the diversity categories. Numbers are almost identical. Numbers of applications, numbers of out-of-state applications, et cetera, but I won't bore you with the numbers. They're very similar to what you have heard previously. I want to spend a little bit of time that I have really talking about clinical network development. A lot of the focus now and for the foreseeable future will be developing a broad sort of pluralistic clinical network with a number of different partnerships, with a number of different partners, different types of partnerships, different types of relationships. Many of those are already in play. Some have been concluded. But the net result is that we are able to recruit a number of faculty members in primary care and specialty disciplines, have the academic value that comes from that in terms of teaching and research, and then place those faculty members in various clinical sites that we do not operate but that contribute to the good of the community. So it kind of forestalls any of the possible town gown issues that come when we recruit specialists who may compete in the community, and it puts very high-quality physicians, high-quality academic physicians, into clinical practices in the community, and we're doing that with literally every healthcare entity in Northern Nevada very successfully. That factors into our major partnerships with the VA, with Renown, and the very rapidly developing partnership with Northern Nevada Medical Center. As you know, Northern Nevada Medical Center is a universal health system hospital. Las Vegas has a large network of those hospitals as well. Northern Nevada has a relatively small hospital in Sparks. They're about to break ground in a large hospital in South Reno. We are engaged in very high-level conversations with them about new residency programs, new clinical network development, new practice development, new faculty recruitment, medical directorship placements for our faculty and their hospitals. So there's a lot happening there, all of which contributes to the good of our network development. And we're doing that partly to become more of a clinical force in the community and partly to contribute to our academic missions. The new building on Moana is coming along very nicely in terms of plans, renovations, and refurbishing, still looking ahead, on time for opening sometime after the first of the year. We're also developing plans for a new practice out on the northwest side of town, headed towards the Somerset area, which is a very high-need area for women's health and pediatrics. We're developing plans for moving out of Renown for our internal medicine practice and department and moving into the community into some very high-quality space there. You'll hear about that at a special meeting later this summer. The practice plan is doing well. We're going to end the year with a modestly positive bottom line of a few $100,000 going forward. And the practice plan budget is tight, but we think we can continue to maintain that level of performance. Actively engaged in recruiting a new senior associate dean for clinical affairs, a very high-level clinical leadership position. Recruiting a new associate dean for biomedical research to partner with our associate dean for clinical research, Dr. Mark Riddle, who's starting September 1st. The opening of the Clinical Research Center has generated a tremendous amount of attention and already very busy in terms of supporting clinical trials and clinical research activities. Probably the most unfortunate news here is that the pediatrics residency program is still on hold. Renown cannot commit yet to sustainable support, so we cannot launch the startup of that program. I think everyone's still committed to that. The community knows we need this, but Renown has to work through some issues before they can provide sustainable support. And finally, perhaps with regard back to research again, I'll say that we have hit again on a number of large grants. Now, that's the good news. The bad news is that it creates increasing laboratory space stresses and causes us to really have to micromanage every square foot of space to try to make maximal use. Back to the good news again, we function at an extremely high level in terms of grant funding per square foot of lab space, easily toward the top of national numbers in that regard because we manage that space very carefully. Lots more. I'll stop.
Any questions for Dean Schwenk? Chair Page.
Just Dean Schwenk, if you could send us the student breakdown of admissions.
Yes, absolutely.
Appreciate it.
Thanks. Happy to do that.
And Dean, I was going to say congratulations on the 50th anniversary, the gala, the graduation. It was a very nice ceremony.
Thank you for that. We celebrated, I think, enthusiastically and successfully. It was a great year of celebration. Thank you.
And we'll jump into item 7, UNR Med Rural Pipeline Program.
Thank you. My role is to introduce Tamara Martinez-Anderson, our Director of Admissions. She works with Dr. Will Torres, our Assistant Dean of Admissions, Dr. Cherie Singer, Associate Dean of Student Affairs. And Tamara is coming with a presentation about some very exciting collaborations with Great Basin College and in the Elko community at the request of Regent McAdoo, who has stimulated some very exciting partnerships that create pipelines for student success and pipelines for student admissions. And Ms. Martinez-Anderson is right behind me.
Good morning. It's my pleasure to be here today. Again, for the record, I'm Tamara Martinez-Anderson. I am the Director of Admissions at the University of Nevada, Reno School of Medicine. I was fortunate to join this fine institution in October, and almost immediately I was very proud to be part of an institution not only looking at educating future physicians, but committed to a vision of a healthy Nevada. As many of you are well aware, we have a physician shortage in the state of Nevada, especially within our rural communities. As a result of that, I was asked to formulate some plans for how we can better recruit rural students to the School of Medicine. This is important because the evidence suggests that when someone comes, is raised in a rural community, has a connection to a rural community, they are more likely to return there to practice medicine. As we looked at this, we realized that we could put all of our focus into recruiting students to attend medical school, but if you don't simultaneously look at how you help them prepare to be competitive for admission, you will eventually run into problems. Because as we all know, our students need to be well prepared academically. They need substantial experiences in the clinical arena. They need experiences in research. And they need to possess the attributes that we seek in our physicians. And so preparing them to be competitive applicants goes beyond simply encouraging or inspiring them to get in the pipeline to go to medical school. The School of Medicine has great resources and very committed individuals who are excited to recruit students, but in terms of preparing them, I quickly realized that we would need to engage with partners. And fortunately, we have a number of organizations within the state of Nevada who share our vision of a healthy Nevada, especially in terms of reaching out to our rural communities. I need some help. Thank you. Great. Thank you. One of the things that after I had the pleasure of meeting with Regent McAdoo that I quickly turned to was the strategic planning goals for the Board of Regents and was excited at how they align with a proposal that we were starting to develop in terms of outreach to rural students. Like the Board of Regents, we want to provide all students within the state with access to be able to prepare for a career in medicine. We also want to make sure that they have the tools needed to be successful when they go through that application process. And we believe that by engaging in these two things, that we're going to be able to close that achievement gap that sometimes students have who are not attending one of our flagship universities at UNLV or UNR. And by then doing that and increasing the percentage of rural students who attend medical school, we will be able to address that workforce shortage. And as a sort of benefit to all of this, one of the areas that we ask prospective medical students to do is to engage in research. And we see opportunities for working with partners to help them engage in the type of research that will actually come back to benefit the state of Nevada. As I mentioned, when I looked around and said, how are we going to do this? How do we increase rural students? It was clear that we already had some partners, and they have already confirmed their interest in participating in this proposal. That includes Great Basin College, as well as our Office of Statewide Initiatives at UNR Med, the Embry program committed to biomedical research, the AHEC programs, especially in Elko with the Frontier Area Health Education Center, as well as with the new Elko Family Medicine Center, or at least new in terms of having our residents there. We also see long-term opportunities for adding partners to this, including other Nevada health centers, clinics, hospitals in the region, in our rural regions, as well as engaging with Great Basin College beyond the biology department, and eventually moving towards Western Nevada College. At this stage, we have some great foundational programs in place. In 2015, as you know, Great Basin College approved a four-year biological sciences bachelor's degree, which is integral to students being able to prepare for medical school. It was we also have the Embry program located on the Great Basin College, which includes a full-time student support staff member who works with a student group and carefully prepares them with the resources that they need in order to be successful in that biology program. Here at University of Nevada, Reno, we host students who can come and engage in research on the campus from Great Basin College. And we've got the AHEC program located in Elko, who have formulated partnerships to increase the number of students interested in healthcare professions. As we move forward, we're recognizing that we can build on those foundations, but we need to be able to provide additional resources to the students who are interested in medicine. Unlike our larger universities, Great Basin College does not have pre-professional advisors. They do not offer MCAT preparation courses outside of what's available in commercial plans. There is a limited availability of clinical experiences that students in Las Vegas or Reno have greater access to, and they have limited opportunities for research. So we want to be able to formulate a plan where we can utilize the existing staff, the existing partners, and move forward to address all of these needs. We've already started doing that by increasing the visits to Great Basin College where we can interact face-to-face with prospective medical students. We have been enabling the students from Great Basin College to sit in using distance learning to the MCAT prep courses that we offer here at UNR, and we're able to utilize our researchers both within Embry as well as at the clinics in terms of providing them with opportunities to research and engage in clinical experiences. So we feel like we've got some forward momentum, and now our next steps are really identifying the additional funding and staffing that will be needed to bring all of these partners together to track what we're doing and to be able to demonstrate the outcomes. I want to thank you again for your time, and if there are any questions.
Thank you for your presentation. Any questions from Regent Trajan?
How many physicians are needed to serve the rural communities in Nevada?
That is a question I don't actually have. I don't know if anyone from Statewide, the Office of Statewide Initiatives, is here.
Tom Schwank, for the record. We get asked that question a lot, and the answer is a lot. And I don't mean to be facetious, but that we are so far behind, we could place physicians and other health professionals in literally every rural community, and we could keep placing and keep placing and not stop for a long time.
But I think it would be very helpful for us as a governing board to understand what that number is, and the same question for PAs. And then the follow-on question would be, if the state were to have a tuition forgiveness program in exchange for agreement for a physician and a PA to practice in the rural counties, what would be the cost of that? I think those are very important questions for us to answer. It's really great to look at how we increase the pipeline, but I think until we focus on that, we really don't have a chance of solving the problem.
I agree. Dr. John Packham, as you know, is the expert here, and we could put that on the agenda perhaps for September or December and have a much more detailed report. I will comment, however, as I'm sure you all saw, that late in the legislative session, a bill to provide substantial increases in state funding for loan repayment was approved. I'm not sure if it's signed yet, but that will draw down a federal match that will substantially increase loan repayment opportunities for physicians who go into these rural areas. So there was a good step forward there.
Thank you, Regent Trajan, and thanks for the presentation again, and we will bring that forward maybe on the next health science meeting. Thanks. Chair Page said we could have 5 minutes and we can finish, go to item 8, UNLV School of Dental Medicine, Faculty of Dental Practice. Dr. Marcia Dittmeyer.
Good morning. Thank you. For the record, my name is Marcia Dittmeyer. I am the Associate Dean for Academic Affairs at the UNLV School of Dental Medicine. I was asked to provide a brief update on the faculty dental practice, and doing so, I'll provide just a short or brief background and then some of the key updates. In January of 2018, we established an Office of Compliance and Integrity. In doing so, a committee was formed, the Compliance and Integrity Committee. We also formed a subcommittee for infection control. We reviewed our quality assurance and sort of updated our protocol for quality assurance that dealt with both the provider issues as well as patient issues. In February, we appointed a new faculty practice director and an associate director. These individuals, so what was changed there was they only provide care in cases of emergency as well as if a faculty member for whatever reason doesn't show up and a patient is there, they would then fill in. So basically backfilling and for emergencies only. The faculty dental practice developed a new mission statement that focused on comprehensive care. They reviewed their billing processes and provided a new process by which the faculty would be able to review their payments. So what basically happens now is each faculty practice provider has a binder, and it shows everything that they've done. The provider reviews it. They sign off or initial it to make sure that it is the work that they did before the faculty practice director signs off on it, and they get paid. This way that everybody knows what is to be paid, and that is actually what is paid out. They restructured the Faculty Enterprise Committee, so now the committee is formed, has two appointed and two elected members. The faculty practice director is the chair and would only provide a vote if there was a tie or a tie-breaking vote. That's been in place now as well. We've also been working with Axiom, which is our electronic health management system, to try to provide better reports or reports that are easier for us. We're in the process of hiring a clinical operations research analyst who then not only would help us pull data, but also provide better analytics for us to be able to look at trends and be able to make better decisions. Along with all of that, there were some chain of command changes that were added to the dental school itself. We now have, our director of information technology, who was serving as our security officer, is now, it's listed on our org chart that he is the official security officer. Our privacy officer is our new compliance officer. That position was originally held by our quality assurance person, but now that person is our privacy officer. We now have a new assistant dean of finance. We also have a new director of clinical business operations to review all of that, and in the process of hiring a new budget analyst. As far as oversight goes, I mentioned previously the billing process, which is one of the oversight processes that we had. The plan, of course, in reviewing the plan, we ensure that it does abide by all UNLV and NESHI rules and regulations. It still does the plan itself and any affiliation agreements that go along with it. Any amendments that go with the faculty plan are reviewed by the Faculty Enterprise Committee first. They are then submitted to the dean. The dean makes the decision, and then that is reported to the vice president, the executive vice president and provost on the main campus. There are oversight for fiscal responsibility and reporting on a regular basis. So we do report on a regular basis, and the provost is, it says in there, as needed, but at least annually, a report would be made to the provost. Also, one of the things that we did was reviewed the provider agreements, and so now they're outlined very detailed, and each provider has to fill out and sign a provider agreement. The last thing I wanted to mention is the compensation plan, because that was an issue. So just a little brief background. Originally, when the school was formulated, we didn't have a faculty practice. So agreement was made between the then President Harder and the then Dean Patrick Ferrillo that our faculty members who, to maintain their clinical skills, would be able to practice outside one day a week, and that's the way it was. 2009, when the faculty practice was developed, those that had established practices sort of, I guess to say, grandfathered in, they continued to do that. As of July 1st this year, that will change. So they'll have two options, and we're in the process right now of collecting their elections, if you will. Those that choose to practice in the dental faculty practice will choose to do so. They will receive 33% of the collections. Prior to this, it was 40%, but that was after we took out all of the lab bills and materials and things like that, which kind of delayed payments. So now it's 33% of all collections, just straight up. They'll sign for that election, but those that have established outside and choose to do so, their FTE will be reduced from 0.1 from 1.0 to 0.8 to make up for that 20%. They will also be required to complete all of the conflict of interest, abide by the conflict of interest policies and procedures that we have at UNLV. So they are in the process right now of making their elections so that effective July 1st, that will go into effect. And that was really all my updates.
Thank you for that presentation. I think we have one question. Regent McAdoo?
Oh, yes. It's somewhat of a comment. With your new compliance officer, I immediately thought of the compliance officer in the whole system, Misty Galicia, who serves the system. And I just wanted to confirm, I think she could be a valuable resource to your compliance officer if you haven't been able to make that connection yet.
We actually have a School of Dental Medicine work group in which Misty is a member of. So
okay,
we have been
great.
Meeting regularly with her.
Thank you for confirming that. Okay. I appreciate it.
Any other questions from the board? Seeing none. Again, thank you for the presentation and the update. That was for information only. We're going to go into new business. Any new business from the committee? With the exception, we'll talk about that rural stuff, I would assume, in September. Seeing no new business, we're going to go to public comment. Is there any public comment in Elko?
No public comment from Elko.
Any public comment in Las Vegas?
We have none in Las Vegas.
Thank you. Any public comment here in Reno? Seeing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.